Evergreen Sermons Online in Pastor Michael Gabbert's Wednesday night series on the book of Revelation. This message is from March 23rd, 2016.
Good evening. Good evening. I'm glad you guys are here. I appreciate you being a part of this. We had a week off last week for spring break. So I want to set the stage for tonight. I want to do a little bit of background. So if you go to the book of Genesis with me, the last time we met, we were in Revelation chapter 16. And after the long, parenthesis that we saw in those chapters before chapter 16, we were out of the chronology for several chapters as we were given information that filled in the gaps, that fleshed out the storyline. Then in chapter 16, we found ourselves back in the chronology of the story with the seven bowl judgments and the final outpouring of the wrath of God. We're going to look at chapter 17 and 18 over the next 2 weeks. Now, I want to explain before you panic that we're going to somehow try and do both of those chapters tonight. Chapter 17 and 18, as I put in the opening paragraph, they really are a single continuous storyline. There's a reason they're divided into two, and I'm going to talk about that. But I wanted you to see the flow because I've called this, rather than a sidebar or an interlude, I've called this an extended appendix. Because what happens in 17 and 18 is really what was introduced in the last verses of Revelation chapter 16. In the final bowl judgment, where the wrath of God is finally poured out in its fullness, chapter 17 and 18 gives us that imagery. But it's not really a side note over here. It really is the continuation. So it's not chronological in the sense that it's a part of this storyline that we've tried to identify along the way. It is a side note, but it's intimately attached, and it was introduced in the last couple of verses of chapter 16. It is the fall of Babylon, and the reason it's broken up into two chapters is because Babylon is defined in one chapter as a woman riding on a scarlet beast. We're going to see that in chapter 17. And in chapter 18, Babylon is described as a city. Now, there are different images, but the images are talking about the same entity. In other words, as we look at these two chapters, what makes them distinctive, besides the different illustration, is that in chapter 17, let me take a step back. Babylon is the city that is used symbolically in a number of places in the Bible, even in the Old Testament. Babylon is used symbolically to describe the world system that is in opposition to God. Now, that's why I jokingly said go back to Genesis, because there's some speculation that the city of Babylon was possibly the first great city built on the earth. In Genesis chapter 4, we're told that Cain, after he murdered his brother, he is then given a protection that is really a curse by God to wander the earth and to forever be an outcast. It tells us in Genesis chapter 4 that Cain is always going to represent Seth is the son that God gives Eve to replace Abel, who was lost. And Seth becomes the line of those who worship God. Cain produces the line of those who reject God and are rebellious. It tells us in Genesis chapter 4 that Cain had a son named Enoch. And after the birth of his son, Cain, it says, became the builder of cities. And he built a city in Genesis chapter 4, verse 17. And it tells us that he named that city after his son Enoch. Now, there's speculation, but because that city was born out of the rebellion of Cain, there's some speculation that by the time we get to chapter 11, after the table of nations in those early chapters of Genesis and the human population has expanded exponentially, when we get to Genesis chapter 11, we find the story of the Tower of Babylon, or the Tower of Babel. Now, let me just give you a two-minute version of that story, because there's a common misunderstanding that the Tower of Babel was sort of a civic building project, and that men got together and said, let's build a lookout tower, let's build a tourist spot, it'll be the most impressive structure on the earth. And that God, somehow frightened by combined efforts of men, God's response was to confuse their languages and scatter the different languages across the face of the earth. It's really a much more significant story than that. And I just want to read you the verse. Well, let me read you the first couple of verses of Genesis chapter 11. It says, at one time the whole earth had the same language and vocabulary. As people migrated from the east, they found a valley in the land of Shinar and settled there. They said to each other, and this is the verse, come, let us make oven-fired bricks. They used brick for stone and asphalt for mortar. And they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the sky. Let us make a name for ourselves, otherwise we will be scattered over the face of the whole earth. Now, this tower, it's the word that archaeologists use to describe this kind of ancient tower that was being talked about in Genesis chapter 11. The reason I still remember this is because I missed it on an Old Testament test in seminary. And I've remembered it ever since, waiting for somebody to ask me a question where that would be the answer. And nobody ever does, but I'm going to teach you a new word. That kind of ancient tower was called a ziggurat. A ziggurat was not just a tourist attraction. It was not just a tower built as an engineering marvel. It always had some sort of religious significance. What's happening in Genesis chapter 11 is not just that mankind has come together to build something out of the ordinary. What they've done is they have brought human cooperation together as a labor force. They have they're planning to build this tower, which will essentially function as a temple. It's a religious structure. And the fact that they declare that it will reach to the heavens, or my translation says, a tower with its top in the sky, It is a religious statement that this humanly devised religion would have no need of the gods in the heavens. If man wanted to go to the heavens, he would get there himself. In essence, it was a desire to achieve greatness. They say, come, let us make a name for ourselves. And it is the elevation of what we might call the human way, because they say, let us make a name for ourselves, otherwise we will be scattered over the face of the whole earth. When God confused their languages and scattered them over the face of the earth, what he was doing was the very thing that they were most afraid of, which was the dilution of human power and ingenuity. They were not, we have this idea because we've been assaulted by evolutionary teaching for 100 years now. We have this idea that we're a lot smarter than the ancients, but the fact of the matter is, the ancients were much more sophisticated than we give them credit for. They had engineering skills, they had craftsman skills. We think they were all dressed in bear skins and beating on rocks in a cave, and the fact of the matter is, you don't have to go where some of the evolutionists go and try and explain the ancient wonders of the world as sort of evidence of aliens coming to the planet. That comes out of a worldview that says that humans couldn't have possibly known what they needed to know to build these structures, when the fact of the matter is, the evolutionary theory says man started as a monkey and has progressively become more advanced. The reality was God created man as an incredible creature. And by sin's entrance into human nature, we have been on a downward trajectory. Now, our technology in recent years, in the last several hundred years, has gone back up. But here's the thing. Why do we have such a problem with technology today always having unintended consequences? It's because we're smart enough now to do more stuff, but we're not wise enough to know how to handle what we now know how to do. Well, why is God letting mankind sort of be on the upswing technologically? Because there are some things coming. There will be two witnesses who will have the need to take the message of the gospel to the entire world. There will be events that will need to be recognized by the population of the entire globe. We have seen technology reversed really since the low point of the Middle Ages, I think because God is establishing the capabilities to finish out the story precisely as he has established it. We are not smarter or more intelligent than our ancient forefathers. If anything, sin has continued to damage the human condition. This is how I can prove it to you. Do we not see things that are commonplace today that even in our lifetimes would never have been contemplated? Technology is getting better, but the human condition is getting worse. Well, this is the source. Whether we can go all the way back to Cain or whether we have to start with Genesis 11, this Tower of Babel has always been a city. It was established in the Valley of Shinar, which is in that the Iraqi part of the Middle East. Part of the, maybe if you know your ancient history, the Mesopotamian area and all of that, the Fertile Crescent. So Babylon shows up periodically, sometimes as an actual city, sometimes as a symbol of opposition to God. But going all the way back to the book of Genesis, Babylon always represents this, what I call the human way of doing things. And the tower, the lost ziggurat of Babel, was the first evidence of that. So when we get to these two chapters, Revelation 17 and 18, there are two images. And in the second image, chapter 18 that we'll look at next week, the image is of a city. In chapter 17, the image is of a woman. Now the reason for that is because Babylon represents the full spectrum of rebellion against God. We can most easily summarize it by saying it's rebellion against God religiously, it's rebellion against God politically, and it's rebellion against God economically. You'll remember that the dragon that we saw in chapter 13, he inspires this dark trinity that includes the dragon who desires to take the place of Almighty God. He has one beast who is the Antichrist, and that is the political global ruler of a final worldwide kingdom. And then there is the false prophet, which is the second dragon. He is a religious leader. So you've got inspired by this dragon who is the devil, you have a beast who is a political leader, you have a beast who is a religious leader, and together they build a structure of economic domination globally. We see that in the requirement that you have to have a mark on your right hand or on your forehead in order to buy and sell. See, that's a centralized control of the economic structures of the world. So all three of those aspects of human life are encompassed in this imagery of Babylon. Now, in chapter 18, what we'll see next week is Babylon is described as a city. Because in chapter 18, we're primarily talking about God's judgment on the political and economic aspects of this human rebellion. In chapter 17, Babylon is described as a woman, because chapter 17 is focused primarily on God's dealing with the religious aspect of human rebellion. And so where a city is an appropriate image for politics and economics, chapter 17 uses the picture of a woman because he's going to use the description of a prostitute. The prostitute, prostitution is a word used throughout scripture to describe a spiritual idolatry that captures the world. Now, sometimes, I want you to understand this, when Israel was unfaithful in the Old Testament, oftentimes they were described as adulterers. Now, that doesn't mean that in every Jewish household that there were extramarital affairs taking place. What it means is it was a picture that, because God uses the image throughout the Old Testament, particularly in Hosea the second chapter, verses 19 and 20. In Hosea 2, 19 and 20, God says to Israel, I will betroth you to me. And he gives them five characteristics, and I can't remember them all. I will betroth you to me in righteousness, in faithfulness. I don't remember all five of them, but God says, my relationship to you will be as a husband to a wife, and I will betroth you to me forever, and then you will know the Lord. Two powerful verses. I've used them actually in weddings, because it's not only a picture of God's relationship with Israel, but it's really a description of how God sees marriage. Well, because Israel was viewed as a wife that has been betrothed to the Father, to God, that imagery of that relationship, when she would rebel and fall into idolatry or the worship of false gods, that was often described in terms of adultery or spiritual infidelity, unfaithfulness, if you will. So, and generally, when that kind of spiritual rebellion is described in terms of prostitution, it's not talking about Israel. Now, we can, again, go to Hosea and find that there is that prostitution imagery. But even with Hosea and his wife Gomer, the primary point of the book is her unfaithfulness more than her prostitution. In this chapter, however, when he's talking about Babylon as a great whore or a great prostitute, depending on which translation you're using, it's clear, because that imagery is not usually applied to Israel. It's usually applied to non-Israel. So what's being described here, in chapter 18, it's the political and economic part of human rebellion as embodied in a city. But in chapter 17, it's the religious aspect of human rebellion as embodied in the illustration of a woman who is a prostitute or a whore, and her rebellion must be dealt with by the justice of God. Now, all of that is background. We haven't even read the text yet, okay? So let's go to Revelation chapter 17. The reason I gave you this chapter the way I did, you'll see that chapter 17 is divided into two sections, and then I've listed four sections at the very bottom of the page. Certainly, we can't do chapter 17 and 18 together in a single night, but because, in my view, it's a single storyline, I wanted to put it all together, and if we can get through 17, then we'll just pick up, I'll give you a printout next week with these bottom 4 points, and we'll just carry this drama into chapter 18. So, chapter 17, verse 1. In fact, let's drop back. I just want to read you at the end of chapter 16. In verse 19, this is in the middle of the discussion of the seventh and final bowl of judgment. And in chapter 19, it says, the great city split into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell. Babylon the Great was remembered in God's presence. Remember, we talked 2 weeks ago about how in terms of judgment, it's not a good thing to be remembered. in God's presence. Because when God remembers in this moment, what does he do? He gave her the cup filled with the wine of his fierce anger. Remember, that's the same cup that we saw earlier that is described as undiluted, or in the Greek, the wine of God's wrath mixed, unmixed. Well, that introduces what we see in 17 and 18. Verse 1, chapter 17. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me. Now, this is why I haven't made it an interlude on the side. It really is an appendix, because it's one of those seven angels that delivered one of the bowls of judgment that is making this announcement. So this chapter is not a part of the chronology necessarily, but it is showing how these bowl judgments, the consequences as they're spilled out on the earth. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me. Come, I will show you the judgment of the notorious prostitute who sits on many waters. The kings of the earth committed sexual immorality with her, and those who live on the earth became drunk on the wine of her sexual immorality. So he carried me away in the desert, in the spirit to a desert. I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had seven heads and ten horns. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold, precious stones, and pearls. She had a gold cup in her hand, filled with everything vile and with the impurities of her prostitution. On her forehead, and this is a terrible translation, on her forehead a cryptic name was written. I'll explain that in a minute. Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and of the vile things of the earth. Then I saw that the woman was drunk on the blood of the saints and on the blood of the witnesses to Jesus. When I saw her, I was greatly astonished. Now, this is a powerful six verses that we need to give our attention to. Because in these 10 verses, he's going to give us 10, I'm not going to go through them necessarily in this order, but he gives us 10 distinguishing marks that we can use to understand who this woman is, to come to the conclusion that I've already given you, that this is the embodiment of human rebellion, particularly in its religious aspect. All right? He starts by saying that one of those angels involved in the bowl judgments came and announced this, and he says, come, I'll show you the judgment of the notorious prostitute. As I said, this word is not the word adulteress. It's not speaking of God's people. It is this idea of earth's inhabitants who have prostituted themselves. They have been given an understanding of who God is, and yet they have turned away to follow another god. This notorious prostitute who sits on many waters. Now, just drop down for an explanation. Because sits on many waters would seem to imply some sort of hint about location or something. The reason we know these two chapters are not a part of the chronology is because John's going to give us clear direction, which is what we always look for when we're finding symbols. He's been real good at telling us when what we see is a symbol. And here he said he sees this prostitute sitting on the waters. In verse 15, that's explained to him. It says, the waters you saw where the prostitute was seated are peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages. So it's not the image of a woman actually in some watery location. It's a symbol of all the nations and people groups of the earth. In other words, this woman who represents the religious rebellion of the human condition, she has influence across the board of the population of the earth. Now understand, of the population of the earth that's present at this time and this place, which is during the period of the tribulation. He says, let me go back up to the top. He says, the kings of the earth committed sexual immorality with her, and those who live on the earth became drunk on the wine of her sexual immorality. Basically, he's saying that the angel is telling him that the inhabitants of the earth as a whole were happy to be seduced. And they drank with gusto of the wine of her seduction. It says in verse 3, so he carried me away in the spirit to a desert. Now, Now that's interesting. Listen, there's not anything in the Word of God that is insignificant. I mean, the Bible is written with such an economy of language that when something seems to stand apart from the rest of the story, you have to stop and ask why. As I've contemplated this, I'm convinced that by taking John in the Spirit, now again, we're not talking about physically, in the Spirit means this is a vision, these are symbols that he's perceiving. But it says it took him to the desert. The desert was detached from the great city, okay? We're talking about Babylon in terms of a woman here, but soon we'll be talking about Babylon in terms of a city. By taking John in the Spirit to the desert, he had a distance and a perspective on what was happening, a kind of clarity, I think, that comes from seeing this unfolding judgment of God in a big picture kind of way. He's removed far enough so that he can see all that God is unfolding. And he tells us what he saw. This prostitute, this woman, I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had 7 heads and 10 horns. Now what's interesting here is this is the reference to a scarlet beast covered with blasphemous names. This is easily seen as the same beast that we saw in chapter 13. The beast who is the Antichrist can be described. Scarlet is a color of blood. It's the color of bloodthirstiness. But not only that, he's covered with blasphemous names, 7 heads and 10 horns. Now we'll get an explanation for this in the verses that are coming. So let's wait until it makes it a lot easier to explain when the angel is going to tell us what they mean. So we'll look at that in just a minute. He goes on to say the woman was dressed in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold, precious stones, and pearls. Now think about this. We're talking about the religious aspect of human rebellion against God. So if we're talking about this rebellion in terms of religion, see what we already have here. This is the religion, the global religious system of the last days. It is marked by its global influence. She sits on the waters, which represents all of the nations and peoples and languages of the earth. So this religious system has a global influence and impact. The kings of the earth committed sexual immorality with her. In other words, this is, let me see, how can I describe it? This is an unholy... This is an unwholesome union of church and state. That's what it means, this idea. She represents the global religious system, but she's symbolically in bed with the political rulers across the earth. That's what this verse means. The kings of the earth had committed sexual immorality with her, and those who live on the earth became drunk. Political leaders are in bed with this religious whore. But the people of the earth, not just the movers and shakers, but just the regular people, they were content to be caught up in this delusion and in this seduction. They also drank from the wine of her sexual immorality. This woman is sitting on a scarlet beast. The beast represents, as we've said, the beast represents this beast that we've seen in earlier chapters. So the fact that she sits on that beast tells us a couple of more things about this global religious system. Number one, she has an intimate partnership with the beast who is to be the political ruler, the global dictator on the earth. But at least at this point in the story, the religious, I mean, think about when you sit on a horse. Now, I've been on a horse before where the horse was in charge. I mean, that's happened to me a couple of times in my life. But ideally, the person riding the horse is the one in charge. That's the point James makes when he says you put the bit in the mouth of a horse and you tell him where to go just with a little bit of effort. So the image here is that in the early stages of this tribulation period, the Antichrist, which is our big bugaboo, I mean, that's who gets all the press. But in the early days of the tribulation, the Antichrist is actually a servant to the religious aspect of human rebellion. Now, she's sitting on the scarlet beast, which means she's in control, but there's an intimate partnership here. I mean, they're in this together. And we'll come back to the description of the beast. She's dressed in purple and scarlet. Purple is the color of royalty. Scarlet is the color of blood. She's adorned with gold, precious stones, and pearls. Now think about this. If we want to talk about the faith of the Messiah, when Jesus came, he said, down is up, up is down. Whatever the world, in a sense, has presented to you, I'm telling you it's the other way around. Jesus came to set the record straight. Well, the church is gone. Now, there are tribulation saints. We've seen those throughout the story. But what's happening here is at this pinnacle of human-made religion that either culminated or maybe started, but came to a level that required the judgment of God all the way back in Genesis chapter 11. I mean, it was already out of control. Here we are thousands of years later, and what John is seeing is that human impulse to have religion in a man-made way has reached its climax. Now, what happens when religion follows a man-made system? It always goes for the wealth. Listen, this prostitute, she's not some street person dressed shabbily. She is dressed like a queen. This is a religious system that has promised wealth, that has displayed a kind of excessive and tasteless gaudiness. There is nothing that this representation of human rebellion finds distasteful. There is nothing too gaudy, nothing too pretentious, nothing that should be laid aside. More is always better. I'm telling you, that's always where human-made religion ends up. She had a gold cup in her hand, filled with everything vile and with the impurities of her prostitution. Now, I don't want to be overly graphic, but let me point out a couple of things here. She had a gold cup in her hand. The cup that Jesus drank from on the night before the crucifixion, the cup that we will share this Friday night when we come together for what we call a service of darkness, the cup that is sometimes called a chalice, in medieval tradition it's called the Holy Grail, the cup of the supper. We don't know exactly what Jesus drank from, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't gold. It would have been much simpler than that, because there was nothing about the cup that was significant. The significance of the cup was because he held it up and he said, this is the symbol of my blood that I spill out for you. But see, counterfeit religion can never get to the heart of things. It always stays at surface level. So this cup that this religion offers is gold. It's extravagant. It's glamorous. It's attractive and appealing. Except the simple cup of Christ, you take it, and it is the call to do this in remembrance of me because he has poured out his blood to secure our redemption. this cup, it has to be an attractive cup because the contents, and this is where I don't want to get overly graphic, but this is a very tame translation of the Greek. It says she had a gold cup in her hand filled with everything vile and with the impurities of her prostitution. In other words, the wine being offered here is in essence the fluid dregs from the filth of her behavior. And it's being offered to be consumed, to be swallowed. It is a picture of such vile, disgusting imagery. And yet the whole world, they've become drunk on it. On her forehead, and this is the bad translation. My translation, the Holman, says, on her forehead a cryptic name was written. They've taken a word. The word that's used here is mysterion, which is translated most often mystery. And they've interpreted this verse to say, in other words, what they're saying is, on her forehead was a mysterious name. And then they give the name that John saw on her forehead. Now you say, why are these words on her forehead? Remember, these are symbols. These are images. But I don't think that's the right translation. On her forehead, a mysterious or cryptic name was written. I think that the word mystery or mysterion is actually part of the name. In the Bible, a mystery is seldom used the way we use it. When we talk about a mystery, when we say I read a mystery novel, we mean that there's been a crime in a crime scene, or there's been an event that has to be explained, and we solve mysteries. In Greek, the word mystery is not something you solve. A mystery, the Greek word for mystery, is something that can't be known unless somebody tells it to you. You can't figure out a mystery. You have a mystery revealed to you. So what happens here is he's saying there is on her forehead a name, and the name was mystery. Now, why would that be the name? Why do I think that's the name and not just a description? Because I think the way it's written in the Greek, I think mystery is the key word saying that there's no way to know who this woman is without it being revealed to us. And here's the revelation. And this is the first time the word shows up in this chapter. She is Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and of the vile things of the earth. The mystery that was not obvious is made known by this revelation that this woman represents the spiritual or religious essence of human rebellion. And John says, when I saw her, let me do the whole verse. Then I saw that the woman was drunk on the blood of the saints and on the blood of the witnesses to Jesus. Now, I can't skip that. Let me talk about that. Because we're talking about a religious structure here. A global religious system would be a better word. And yet, because this global religious system is in rebellion to God, what is necessary for this system to do? They have to eliminate opposition. Well, where will the opposition come from? The blood, the saints and the witnesses to Jesus. Those who have come to the Messiah, whether Jewish or Gentile, in the time of the tribulation, they are critical threats to a global system. Let's think about it in these terms. We are not in the tribulation today. Not yet. But can you not see the passion with which believers are attacked if they dare suggest that the way the culture operates is not true. Well, I believe that marriage is between a man and a woman. You're a hater! Well, I think that babies should be allowed to be born if they're conceived. Well, that's just unreasonable. You see the latest thing in the last couple of weeks? The Justice Department is pondering what would be necessary to bring legal proceedings against global warming deniers. If you disagree with the global system in place, you must be silenced. And the best way to silence somebody is to take their life. This is a religious system, but there is blood on her hands. She's drunk on it, and it's the blood of the saints and the blood of the witnesses to Jesus. John says, when I saw her, I was greatly astonished. That's another weak translation. The Greek literally uses two words to emphasize that sentence. What it literally says is, I was astonished with a great astonishment. I was stunned by an overwhelming stunning. I mean, he's using those words. Now why? I mean, think about this. We're in chapter 17. John has seen some pretty amazing things. I mean, go back to chapter 1. He had a vision of the risen Lord. Chapters 4 and 5, he was in the throne room of heaven. He saw the one seated on the throne, surrounded by a rainbow that had the color of emeralds. He's seen the 24 elders. He's seen the four living creatures. He's seen angels beyond count. He's seen the church singing in worship in a multitude of voices that couldn't be numbered, that sounded like the roaring of waters. I mean, he has seen some pretty amazing things. But he's never seen anything like this. I was astonished with a great astonishment. This is one of the original 12 disciples. He's in the desert watching with clarity from a distance what's unfolding. And he says, the religious part of humanity, that part of us that is unique to all of creation, that part of us that was placed here so that we could be in relationship with God, that part of us that yearns to worship. In all of the thousands of years of human history, I mean, John had seen the Roman Empire. He was on the island of Patmos. He knew what persecution was. But even with everything that he had seen, both in this book by vision and in his own life as a victim of Roman persecution, John could barely fathom what he was looking at. This persecution of the saints by the very system that claimed to meet that innate need of the human existence, that need to worship and to be in relationship with the God who made us. Listen, the political and the economic side of this, we can sort of figure out, but this religious aspect, it's unthinkable. How have we gotten to this point? I'll tell you how. Because behind every single bit of this is one rebellious angel who is determined to be worshiped as God Almighty. That's why the religious part of this story is, to John's mind, the hardest to fathom. Unthinkable. Well, verse 7. Then the angel said to me, why are you astonished? I don't know, just because I... He says, I'll tell you the secret meaning of the woman and the beast, the one with the seven heads and the ten horns that carries her. Now, this is why I've spent 50 minutes on six verses, but this is why I didn't go into more detail, because the angel's going to tell us. We don't have to hunt for this. We don't have to speculate. He says in verse 8, the beast that you saw was and is not and is about to come up from the abyss and go to destruction. Now, this is the same language that we saw in chapter 13. This beast that was and is not and is about to come up from the abyss and go to destruction. Remember in chapter 13, we saw this beast that had a wound to his head that was unto death. Remember, we talked about a counterfeit resurrection. There is the image that he has somehow been killed, but he comes back to life. Everything that Satan does in Revelation is a counterfeit of what God is doing in the unfolding story of redemption. Well, so John, the angel uses that same language with John so that John makes an instant connection. What he saw here as a scarlet beast is that beast, that political dictator that will rule the earth. Now, he was and is not, that is, he died, he's about to come up from the abyss and go to destruction. I love the end of this verse, because what the angel knows that John needs to know is that in the heart of the tribulation, it's going to look like success for the Antichrist. But his time is short, and he will eventually go to destruction. Now, the next verse. Oh, next sentence. Those who live on the earth, don't miss this. Those who live on the earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world will be astonished when they see the beast that was and is not and will be present again. In other words, this phony resurrection is designed to take the undiscerning population of the earth, those whose names are not written in the book of life, and it'll fool them. I mean, they are going to buy it hook, line, and sinker. Verse 9. But here's the mind with wisdom. That is, the others. Those whose names are written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. They will have the mind of wisdom, and they will understand what he's going to unfold in these verses. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. Now, if we just stop there, you know, we've talked about the different cities that show up in Revelation, and some people want to make Babylon a reference, a symbolic reference to the city of Rome. And they go to this verse, and they quote this verse. Well, the seven heads are seven mountains. Well, everybody in the ancient world, John included, recognized that Rome was known as the city built on seven hills. In fact, the hills had names, and that was a commonplace description. But here again, we're in a chapter of symbols. Well, how do we know the hills are symbols? Because we're going to read the next verse, and the angel's going to tell us. He says, the seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. They are also seven kings. Now, the word here is translated kings, and that's the right word. But the language of fallen is really a language that describes kingdoms or empires as opposed to individual kings. So I think that, you know, when you hear somebody say, for example, Castro's Cuba or Obama's America, we sometimes will use the reference to a particular leader as a reference to a nation or a kingdom or an empire. I think that's what's being done here. These seven mountains are really seven kings. Now, he's going to give us the historical look. Five have fallen. One is. The other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must remain for a little while. Now, why does Revelation talk this way? Because it was written to be timeless. And every generation has had to ponder this language. Think about the history of humanity. He says those seven mountains, in a sense, the seven kings or the seven empires, all of human history, biblically, is basically summarized by empires. Now that doesn't mean that one butts up against the next and there's no gaps in between, but it's the same that as we talk about periods of history. We say, well, there's the period of the Middle Ages. Well, the period of the Middle Ages was followed by the Renaissance. Well, when did the Middle Ages stop and when did the Renaissance start? Well, every historian picks a different significant event that is this transition point. But the reality is we understand that history sort of just oozes along. It doesn't turn on a dime. You don't say, oh, we're in a new period now. It happened last night. We that's gone and now we're in a new, it's not like that. And so when the Bible talks about the expanse of human history, it often does it in terms, we saw it in the book of Daniel, we've seen it in some of the other prophets, it does it in terms of kingdoms or empires. So when he says there are seven, who's he talking about? Five have fallen. Historically, at the time John receives this, what's being said is that there are five major empires that have existed in human history that are not there anymore. Well, it doesn't take much, either biblically or historically, to track that down. They are universally recognized as Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, or the Medo-Persian Empire, and the Greek Empire, under Alexander the Great and later under his four generals that divided it up. You can go all the way back to the time of Moses when Egypt was the superpower on the earth. And you can basically follow, you know, Assyria was the superpower when Israel was taken into exile and the 10 tribes disappeared. Babylon was the superpower when Judah, the two tribes remaining, were taken into exile for a period of 70 years. They were released because the Medo-Persian Empire had emerged and God used the rulers of the Medo-Persian Empire to allow three waves of refugees to return to the Promised Land. By the time we get to the end of the period of silence, the 400 years between the Testaments, we find there the history of the Greek Empire. Alexander the Great conquers the world. He marches his armies off the map of the known world and creates an empire. He dies young and in those 400 years, and this is because our Bible doesn't cover this, that's where we have this question. We always wonder, you know, why were the Persians in control at the end of the Old Testament and the Romans are in control when we get to the first page of the New Testament? And we know Alexander the Great's in there somewhere, but that's what's happened. Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece. Who was in charge when John was alive? Rome. Five have fallen. One is... that's Rome. The other has not yet come. There's still a kingdom to come. And when he comes, he must remain for a little while. Now these empires, by and large, lasted for a long time in terms of human history, particularly the Roman Empire, between the Republic and then the Empire, Rome basically dominated both the Western and Eastern world for, I don't know, 700 years. But if you count the Holy Roman Empire that was kind of a revival in the Middle Ages, Rome continued to be kind of the dominant political idea virtually to the Renaissance. But there's one more kingdom coming, but it's not going to last a long time. He must remain for a little while. the beast that was and is not is himself an eighth king. Yet he belongs to the seven and is going to destruction. Okay. Verses 10 and 11 are two of the funnest verses in the Bible to figure out. Now, I've given you five empires. One is, that's Rome, one yet to come. Seven total. But there is a beast who himself will be the eighth king, yet he belongs to the seven and is going to destruction. Let me explain this. Thanks, Pop. Appreciate your confidence. In that last, let me read another verse. I got to do all this together. I have to tie it all together. The beast is himself an eighth king, yet he belongs to the seven and is going to destruction. The ten horns you saw are ten kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but they will receive authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. These have one purpose, and they give their power and authority to the beast. All right, let me put all that package together. Five empires gone. Rome is the one that John knows. There's one yet to come. That one that's yet to come will consist of ten kings that it is absolutely, despite what the experts tell you, it is absolutely impossible to identify who those ten nations are. Man, I've read stuff my whole life. It's the European Union. It's this, it's that. Biblically, you can't identify those ten kings. But they are ten heads of state who at some point will become the emerging final kingdom. And out of those ten kings, either one of those kings or somebody that they agree upon will be the eighth king, but he's part of the seven. See, this seventh empire, which is defined by ten primary nations, will produce the Antichrist. And he will come out of this final kingdom and be a part of that kingdom. But in essence, what he will do, it says they have one purpose. Why will God let this final kingdom assemble politically? These ten nations, whoever they are, whoever the rulers are, why would God allow this to happen? They have one purpose in the big scheme of things, and that is to hand authority to the Antichrist. And he will emerge out of this confederacy of nations, and by the authority handed to him, he will eventually become a global dictator. They have one purpose. They give their power and authority to the beast. These, meaning the ten kings, this king, this empire that consists of these nations, these will make war against the Lamb. But the Lamb will conquer them because he is Lord of Lords and King of Kings. Those with him are called, chosen, and faithful. These ten kings, and here again, we're in a chapter of symbols. So it is even possible that that ten is a number of completion. That may be why it's been so hard to really identify. All this means is that there will be a confederate of nations that will be complete, that God allows to emerge out of them by their authority that they hand over, will come this beast who will become the Antichrist. He is the political leader that we will really deal with in chapter 18. I don't want to quit. Can we do five more minutes? I want to get to this. The angel also said to me, the waters you saw where the prostitute was seated are peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages. We've already seen that. The ten horns you saw and the beast will hate the prostitute. They will make her desolate and naked, devour her flesh, and burn her up with fire. Now look at what's being described here. The religious system in the early days of the tribulation actually rules with authority over the political system. But when power has been consolidated and handed to the beast, all of a sudden, the political leaders don't have use for the religious system any longer. You know, the communists have always said that religion was an opiate for the people. Religion was a tool to use to keep the masses settled. Well, what happens here in the tribulation is when religion is no longer needed to consolidate power, guess what they do? They do away with it. Chunk it. It's gone. The image here is visceral. They make her desolate and naked, devour her flesh, and burn her up with fire. Now here's what I want you to see. Two things. This is the inherent disunity of evil. Evil cannot help but cannibalize itself. It happens every time. I mean, when Hitler couldn't shoot at allies, what did he do? He executed his own generals. Evil will always cannibalize itself, and that's what happens here. But look at this. Not even that is outside the realm and the plan of God. For God has put it into their hearts to carry out his plan by having one purpose and to give their kingdom to the beast until God's words are accomplished. God uses the inherent disunity and confusion of evil against itself to accomplish precisely what he meant to accomplish all along, which is the destruction of evil. Why destroy evil when God can put it in the minds of evil men to do it themselves? See, if God hadn't judged, going all the way back to Genesis chapter 11, if God hadn't judged mankind, you know what would have ultimately happened? They'd have torn that tower down. They would have cannibalized themselves in the grasping for power that is inherent in fallen human nature. The last verse, and the woman you saw is the great city that has an empire over the kings of the earth. That verse transitions us from the destruction of the religious rebellion. We shift from the woman to the city. And in chapter 18, we will see God break down by judgment the political and economic rebellion of the human race. Let's pray together. Father, thank you that your word is certain, that it is understandable. Father, I don't know how many times I've been told that Revelation can't be understood, and yet as we place ourselves under the tutelage of your Spirit, it makes sense to us. Thank you for that. Father, let us have minds of wisdom in our generation so that we can see what you're about, what you're up to, so that we can recognize, like the sons of Issachar, the way that the people of God should go, because we understand the times in which we live. Father, I pray that as we walk through this story of Babylon, when we get to the next chapter, that you will give us the same heart that cries for justice that we will see there. Father, thank you for the truth of your word. We pray it tonight in Jesus' name. Amen.